Thanks for having me. Can everybody hear me if I stay down here? Okay, awesome. Hannah's going to load up the slides for us here. My business name is Alexia Hall, so you can seek me out that way too. I have a background in registered dietitian. I worked at UC Davis Medical School, like she said, and also got to work at CHOC, Children's Hospital of Orange County, sometimes with the early premature infants, as well as food allergy and oncology survivorship. I started into private practice in 2022 and now work with oncology families through Max Love Foundation, if you've heard about them. They started in Orange County. But culinary medicine is my jam. It's something that I absolutely love and I think makes a big difference. So what we have to talk about today is what is the things that our government bodies and research says our kids are supposed to eat. But the bigger question in the room is how do we get these little guys to eat it? And that's always the challenge. And then I wanted to identify some of the more challenging aspects of eating, some of the reasons why we might need a professional, either a ENT type doc or a speech language pathologist or something like that. The behavioral things are not easy. Spoken by somebody who knows, a mom of a child who would only eat five things when she was 4 years old. So, but also myself personally, because I had to learn to eat vegetables right along the same time that she did, because I didn't really enjoy them either. So experience, personal experience helps. And then we're going to do a fun craft at the end that involves food and a concept of teaching fiber and the importance of fiber. So something you can do with your kids as well. So just a little bit about me, you've already heard it. I'm pointing it in the wrong direction, I think, there we go. If I'm okay with you, I'd like to start off with a prayer, just that God would bless our time together. Father God, thank you for gathering these women together. Thank you for the mentor moms. Thank you for the platform that PCC makes available so that we can thrive all together. We know in this community that there is support, there is other moms who've been through it, who know, and we just ask you to bless our time, Father, that we could go forth from here learning and helping others. In your name we pray. So eating should be fun, should be joyful, but we know that sometimes it can be a real struggle, especially with our two-year-olds going on up. Wrong clicker, there we go. So let's just hit it off first with the what. So everybody has on their table a handout that there are several different institutions in the United States that provide handouts that look exactly like this. I used to work at UC Davis Medical Center, and this is theirs. I love it because of the detail that it provides on it. Stanford Hospital has one, Boston Children's has one. They're all available online, so if you'd like to check it out, they are available out there. But as you can see, it's a two-page document. On the left-hand column is all of the food groups there. Hopefully you can read your copy better than what that blew up as, but it's not reading very well there. But then in the second column over the 1 year, going into the 2 year, and then on the second page, the 4 and 5 year. So the food groups on the left, starting off with the grains group, it'll detail what I think is so cool about UC Davis's handout is that it details down to the tablespoon. And so as you can see there, it says 6 servings on the left for the bread group. But then in the one-year-old column, a serving might be a half a slice of bread or a half a cup. As you go into some of the older age groups, going into 4, it might turn into a full slice of bread. I use bread as an example, but as you can see right under the statement there, the focus group, is that whole grains are the focus area there. And I have another slide for you that kind of details out the importance of whole grains. But then if you drop down into the veggie column, you'll see that it, I believe it says 3 to 5, right? 3 to 5 on there. And then in the fruit group, 2 to 4. So most advantageous is if we're in the neighborhood of 8 to 9 servings of fruits and veggies in a day. And that's hard to get to. You have to do 2 or 3 at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that is what our NAHANES data, which is the survey module in the United States that we use to see what people are eating, less than 10% of us are getting that, especially in our kids. And so that's a focus point for us. And as you can see on the focus point there also, it says the dark green leafy are the really critical, and those brilliant orange-red colors because of all the nutrients they provide. And then heading into the dairy category, we got to max out 24 ounces of milk in a 1-year-old because you displace iron if you do too much more milk than that. Going over into the 2-year-old category, 16 ounces, and then as you can see in the older groups, it drops even less. Because we displace other nutrients, but we also displace iron when we get too much calcium-containing foods. This particular handout was created in 2014. It talks about some other focus points like hydration, talks about some other focus points like choking hazards and things like that. I know there has been tremendous interest in baby-led weaning. That's probably a topic you're reading about in your magazines and things like that. I just reviewed a huge scoping study where it took 12 different other studies about baby-led weaning, and they were trying to answer the question, what or how much is there a difference between choking events in baby-led weaning versus the old recommendations, which were really provide soft foods? And one thing they found was that there hadn't been, which was kind of a cool thing. They said that mother supervision was the biggest key in, and I shouldn't just say mother, I should say father too, supervision in prevention of choking events, but just allowing some of those net type objects to do whole real foods didn't lead to more choking events, which was pretty cool. But something that was surprising to the researchers that they found is that in the degree of children that were fed adult-type foods, so much more salt and sugar because they weren't doing targeted children foods, which generally have less salt and sugar. So that was just something to keep aware of going forward. That was pretty interesting that came out of that study. On the second page, I believe it goes into food allergy a little bit. And again, because this handout was created in 2014, there's been some really incredible data that has come out about food allergy. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics had put out that you shouldn't do certain allergenic foods until going well into a year. They have since found out, if you want to look up the particular study, it's called PNUT, or peanut study, that the avoidance of peanuts or peanut and nut-containing foods until 1 year actually caused a huge amount of additional allergies in the peanut department. So much so, in fact, that a pediatrician out of Texas actually created a formula to give infants that would sensitize them, that she put micro quantities of different allergens in the formula so that there's a very specific tolerance window between about 4 and 8 months of age, where if you don't get exposure to some of these nutrients, it actually causes greater allergy going forward. And the same with breast milk. If we are not, we do pass micro quantities of these allergens through. So if for some reason a mom has to avoid these things, sometimes these different formulas can help in sensitizing the child so they don't get greater allergy as well. So that is still valid in terms of serving size, but some of those other items on that handout have been updated. There's the 4 and 5. And there's the grain thing I was talking about. Constipation is something that is a huge issue throughout childhood, and it's a growing number. And if you go to any GI doc, they'll say the top 3 things that are necessary to prevent constipation: fluid, fiber, and activity. And that's before they jump off into something anatomical wrong or something biochemical wrong to pin constipation on. And if you look at the top left-hand corner there, for a 1 to 3-year-old, I'm sorry, I don't know if you can see that very well. Yeah, okay. 19 grams of fiber in a day is the recommended amount. And then it jumps up for our older kids. But if we're doing 6 servings of grains a day and we're getting 0.5 gram or 1 gram per serving of fiber, we're at less than 1/3 of where we need to be. That chart on the right there describes so many different flours that a lot of us don't make anymore. And the reason is because they take longer to cook, they're harder to cook, and then sometimes they can be more expensive. But if you look at the difference between, say, rice, a half a cup of rice netting you 1 gram, or a half a cup of buckwheat, you know, 4 grams, that's big. If you take that times 6, you're well meeting your goal for the day. You can also meet it through fruits and vegetables, absolutely, but grains can get you there as well. So we get the extras from food as well. So you have your basics, your protein, fat, carb, but you also have your bioactives, which comes from whole real food. So all of the antioxidants, all of the polyphenols, all the things that promote health. There was an incredible House resolution that was passed in 2023 called House Resolution 1118 that said it's the responsibility of every healthcare provider to talk about nutrition, because 8 of the top 10 chronic diseases are related to nutrition and all of the different things that whole real food does for our health. Incredibly sad, but this whole resolution for the whole United States got $1 million. That was it. And that maybe sounds like a lot, but it's really nothing when you're talking about running a program. So there's a huge rising tide for culinary medicine in the United States, and there's several different very large universities that are really promoting it. One of my favorite authors on this subject, Dariush Mazafarian, was a cardiologist turned culinary medicine fanatic. He's at Tufts University, and he started several different programs and initiatives around the country. Also got to go to a Food as Medicine conference in UCLA a couple years ago. The chief of GenMed at Boston Medical Center was talking about it as well. Think tank policy experts, lawyers, insurance companies, people like that were talking about it. So we thankfully have a rise here. That's a nice chart. I can send any of these slides to you if you're looking for them, find them interesting, but this is something I often provide to clients and say, hey, just pick 5 things in 5 different colors to focus on. Whites can do it for you. Reds can do it for you. It's a chart that on the top talks about all the different things the special colors can do for eyesight, for the immune system, for heart issues, for skin issues. We live in such a sunny area that we can always do more benefit for our skin and our sun exposure. So that's one way of doing these things. Which leads us to, okay, the what is kind of easy, right? We have all kinds of different providers out there that'll tell us what the what is supposed to be, but the how is the tough part. If you've got a kid eating 5 things and you're like, okay, show me the chart, but now let me show you where I'm at, that's a whole different story, and that's when the difficulty comes into place. Before we jump off into more of the behavioral stuff, I just wanted to give a list of some of the symptoms and issues that might cause deeper issues that you need help for. And so number one on the list is anatomical. In my world with a lot of oncology issues, there's medications and there's radiations and there's surgery that can cause some really profound eating dysfunction. And then you're going to want the help of a team made up of speech-language pathologists, social workers, doctors, and ENTs to help with that. The second one down is sensory. That is a great website, Your Kids Table. It's run by an occupational therapist, and there's so many free resources on that site for sensory issues. One of the greatest tips I've learned from her is that children, when they're first learning to eat, they are learning so many different things simultaneously. They're learning how to use a fork. They're learning how to move food from the beginning of their tongue through the back, through the molars, to swallow. And they're trying to figure out how to breathe and swallow at the same time. But there's also other sensory issues. For example, if a child is sitting in a regular chair and their feet are dangling, that gives them a sensory issue where they're trying to keep their body upright and settled. That could make them very uncomfortable sitting in a chair. If they have a high chair where their feet don't actually reach the bottom step and their feet are dangling as well, some signs and symptoms of that is it is super squirming, can't sit still for 10 minutes, can't, you know, seem to take on any other task at the same time as they're just trying to sit and be stable. And so that's something to watch out for. And she has several more available as well. Motor skills, you know, kids progress at all different rates, and your pediatrician will be able to help you there with assessments in terms of motor skills. Taste or texture dysfunction. There's some really cool stuff out there about genetics, for example, genetics that impact your ability and how your ability to taste. I personally have one. It makes vegetables taste incredibly bitter to me. And so broccoli tastes bleh. And asparagus, I don't like the smell at all. And then some, you might know it from like cilantro tastes like soap to some people. But epigenetics is key. So epigenetics is the environment that you bathe your genetics in. And you can epigenetically change a genetic variant that causes you to taste funny by micro exposures and getting your environment to change the way you taste things. So it's something that I had to really undertake in terms of all kinds of tips and tricks, and we'll go into them here in just a second. But biochemical, it is zinc, for example, is a mineral that absolutely impacts your appetite and also your taste centers as well. And it is both the overabundance of zinc as well as the deficiency of zinc that can really cause problems with taste. And so I can't tell you the number of patients that have come to me that were suggested by somebody in the integrative and health world over COVID, how helpful zinc was for COVID and COVID prevention and immune support. And I have patients that have been giving higher per doses of zinc for 4 years still giving zinc and elderberry and echinacea and high doses vitamin C and things like that. It can absolutely displace other minerals in the body, but it can create a past a tolerable upper limit. There are certain reasons that can cause zinc deficiencies in terms of certain medications a child might have to take, but also a really bad extended bout of foodborne illness. If you have chronic diarrhea, that can also cause a zinc deficiency. And so it's a simple blood test at the time you're checking other things to check a zinc level. But there's also things that can pinpoint you to that. For example, ridges on the fingernails, vertical or horizontal, can point you in the direction of magnesium issues. Spots on the fingernails, white spots, can point you in the direction of zinc deficiencies. And so that's something to be aware of as well. All of the above. Behavioral we'll talk a lot more about in the next slides, but if you think it's more serious, some of the symptoms for more serious is coughing with thin liquids. If a child takes a drink and then is going like that, that can be a symptom that the swallow is not as it should be. Hiccuping is another sign after eating chronic-wise. If there's retching or there's a really pronounced gag reflex, that's when you need to go talk to a speech-language pathologist and start with your pediatrician. And so this is another resource, Kids Eat in Color. It's staffed by occupational therapists, PhDs, MDs, RDs. It's an excellent website that gives a ton of information. But this just cracks me up. You know, toddlers want those car keys, and we've got to be in the driver's seat with them. In addition to that, this next one, EllenSatterInstitute.org, is a fantastic resource. This particular lady was she started off as a social worker, but also a nutritionist. And throughout her research, she devised an idea and a concept that is supposed to take all the struggle, all the battle out of eating. How many people have heard this before? Anybody? Laura, have you heard of it? Yeah, that's a good one. And it's just a simple set of rules designed to take the strife out of mealtime. So mom and dad get to decide what, where, and when. The child gets to decide how much and if. And of course, an exception to this rule is if there's severe malnutrition, they've fallen off their growth curve or something like that, we need to look at something else. But if they're growing fine, we decide breakfast is at 8, this and this is gonna go on the table, it's time to eat, come to the dinner table. And if the child doesn't wanna eat or only wants to eat a half a tablespoon, no drama, no strife, no concern. The food just goes into the refrigerator for the next meal, and then gets brought back out again for that. And that's a concept that's designed to take some of the mom's stress away, but also allow the child to regulate appetite and to be able to feel within themselves whether they're hungry or full, as that establishes the beginning of a relationship with food. The other parts of those slow but steady, healthy relationships, Ellen Satter is really big on the idea of no pressure, no bribing in terms of mealtimes. If we think about the concept, I know I heard as a kid, if you don't eat your dinner, you don't get your dessert. You know what I mean? And that puts that connotation on the fact that dessert's yummy, dessert's fun, dessert's exciting. If you gotta slog through the meal in order to get to the dessert, that's what you do. And it just takes that and puts a negative connotation on there. When whole real food, we've got to figure out how to bring that excitement for it and the desire to bless our bodies with it in terms of that. Sitting with a schedule is important. For all kids, we know how critical nap time is to our little guys, and so just starting that expectation off with that. Line three was written for me. I've got to model that behavior because I had to do it right alongside with my daughter. When she was 4 through 7, she was diagnosed with IBS. She had a terrible problem with constipation, and that absolutely can affect appetite and desire to eat as well. But I was not modeling the need for fruits, veggies, and whole grains, and I had to do it right along with her. And so I told her we were gonna do it together, and we were gonna figure out a way to get it in. And I have lots and lots of recipes for you guys to figure out how to get it in. And then also, one of the most important things I think my mom said to me when I was the mom of a young child was that kids will live up to their expectations. And so I was having a problem with any time I needed a babysitter or a friend, the kids weren't going to bed for the babysitter. And she's like, check what you're saying to them, Lexi, because the babysitter would come over and I'm like, well, they're being really difficult. You gotta do this, you gotta do that. And then if you have a problem, call me. And she goes, no, you tell the babysitter, they're going to be good for you. They are going to go to bed. And she said the same thing with food. If you walk into a friend's house and the friend's got an array of food there and you're like, oh, I'm sorry, my child's not gonna eat any of that, they're picky, they'll live up to that as well. And so I've seen situations where kids will come into culinary medicine classes and the moms will come up and they're like, my child's not gonna eat anything that's here. And I'm like, that's okay. Like, it's okay to just even be around the food and allow it in your environment, but don't label right now because that'll make the situation tougher for later. The other last thing is in a lot of our culinary medicine classes, we've actually made these wooden signs with happy faces and sad faces. And so it's totally safe for a kid in one of our classes to hold up a sad face, say, I don't like it, I don't wanna eat it. And then it opens up the door to a discussion. So what kind of language can we give a kid about why they might like something? Is it too crunchy? Is it too spicy? Is it too salty? Do you think it's bitter? And a lot of kids at 1 and 2 won't understand some of this language, but just having this discussion and going into 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, because once you figure out what you don't like about a food, you can have the opportunity to change it. But it also allows a child to explore in their mind what their reaction to food is, and that's huge. So the 5 stages of acceptance of a food was brought about by an occupational therapist and studying it. And it starts off with sight, goes into smell, then touch, then taste, and then swallow. And research says in some foods you gotta do this 15 times before they'll actually swallow it down the back of their throat. And there's some helps along the way. And the big one with sight is that the authors of that Kids Eat in Color website said, marketing sells food. There was this cool study that was done at Cornell University where researchers went in and they said, let's see if we can modify the number of burritos that are purchased through the school cafeteria. You're shaking your head. Did you hear it too? Okay. Because it used to just be bean and vegetable burrito. They changed nothing about this burrito at all, and they renamed it Bionic Burrito and put a cute little sign on there. They doubled the number of burritos they sold just with that. We know that we've got researchers in big food companies, doing exactly the same thing. And we have to figure out a way of the site to make kids appealing to kids, but also the names that we give them, the gorgeous strawberries, the brilliant blue dinosaur kale, some of those exciting names that we can put to food. And then food fun works, so making smiley faces with pancakes and things like that works. Smell, we know that our kids are predisposed to sweet smells, and we know that some of the healthier, like cruciferous veggies, things like that, have a stronger smell. And so working within that smell to do some bridges to help get our kids across the line is a way to do that. A cheese sauce with a broccoli or some kind of a healthy dip that can go along, that can be used to make that bridge for these things. And then touch. We want to create a safe space for our kids to explore the food. We want to allow them to touch the food without forcing them to swallow. And so if your kid has a lot of food refusals, a lot of, I'm not going there, well, let's just think about this. Let's just see, is that celery crunchy? Can we bend it, you know, and start to get that language going that way? And then taste. I know culturally that some families, it's not okay to take a lick and then not eat the food. It's definitely not okay to take something into their mouth and then, if they don't want to swallow it, spit it out. But it does create a safe atmosphere for a kid to allow experimentation and get to that point where they are willing to swallow if they think, well, if I don't like it, I can spit it out. And so you got to do what's right in your own family, but that is one strategy that can help with that. And finally, the swallow, it does take coordination. For somebody who is not used to a certain taste, it can stimulate the gag reflex. So just help with your child through it. Tell them it's okay. Sometimes our body just takes a little while to get used to it, and it may not happen that way next time. Let's try it again when you're ready, type of thing. Providing agency is something that's critically important to our two-year-olds. If our two-year-olds are going to put their feet down and they're not going to do something, it's going to definitely be with food, because you can't make a child swallow if they don't want to. And so it's an area of a point where a child can gain a little control. But all of these suggestions are a way to help a child gain control. And allowing the short meal times, the opportunity to run beforehand, getting their help in preparation. Have you seen some of the step stools where they have the big, wide guardrail around? I'm getting some nodding heads. My niece has one, and she has a 2- and a 4-year-old, and it does two things. One of them, it makes them safe, so they get to the top step, their counter height. She can give them a mat and then give them some herbs to tear and things like that, but they won't fall. It's got guardrails on it, but it also keeps them contained. So you don't have the kid running all over everything, and you've got the knives over here and this over here. They've got their own little workspace, and it can keep things safe while they're helping you cook. But also the adventure toasting games, blindfold will work both with licking, but blindfold will also work with smelling if they're not quite at that licking stage yet. And then allowing a child to make their own food and serve it to you, you've probably experienced that before. It gives them, okay, so we're not in a fire. We don't have to leave. Okay. Okay. And then growing your own kitchen garden is huge. So even if you don't have a garden, there's so many kits on Amazon that you can grow things in mason jars from your kitchen window. And it just gives them, oh my gosh, I grew this, you know? It's very fun. These are some of the classes that we've had with kids. At that Food is Medicine conference that I went to, they said there's two huge rules for culinary medicine. Number one, it has to taste good. And number two, it has to be fun. And so if you can see in the top left there, all of these pictures from Chalk are on their Instagram, so the parents are okay with us sharing. But the top left, we did a monster mash one day to celebrate for Halloween. Let the kids pick what they wanted to decorate their toasts with. Top right, it's a hard-boiled egg made into a snowman, but also a zucchini ribbon with a star, a cheese star, and a cherry tomato to be used as a base. We have an apple grape for Valentine's Day, where you take two slices of an apple and you core out the middle with the cookie cutter, and then a nut butter, and then a nut and seed granola in the middle of that. But I tell you, my favorite classes are at the farm. And what the kids see in wonder when they, like OC Farm and Food Lab, if you've never been there, is at the Grape Park. It's a fantastic place to bring your kids. It's got all kinds of docents that do all kinds of things, from pollinators. They've got chickens. They show you the eggs. And they show you, and they let the kids grab food right out of the ground. And we used to cook there. They're changing to a different location, but it's a year out, but they still have seen a kid grab carrots and then take them and wash them and come over and cook with them. It's magical. It's absolutely magical. And then just looking at, you know, grabbing the lettuce out of the ground and eating it, and the cauliflower. So making those trips to the farmers markets, making those trips to the farms, strawberry you pick, Tanaka has the same thing up in Irvine. A lot of fun. Also, like, say, for example, a red day at the grocery store. Dress up your toddler, let them pick everything red, and say, we're going to pick three red things from the grocery store today. And get your produce manager in on it, and talk to them, because they'll even cut things off and hand it to you. You don't even have to buy it, you know, and they'll talk about what their favorite red thing is. Same thing with farmers at farmers markets. You get a farmer talking about what it's like to grow food, and be excited about it, and those kids are absolutely in, especially if they get to pick a few things at the farmer's market and take it home and eat it. This is that graphic from, it said, at Kids Nutritionist. I'm sorry, that's a little bit blurry, but she's another fantastic one, a dietitian, and she talks about the idea that we as moms put so much work into making a meal, and we offer it, and it's like, yes, they're just gonna eat it because I put so much work in, and here's all my love on a plate, and it's not the way it works. It's, you know, they refuse it. We hope they eat it. They might smell it. They might look at it. They might lick it. They might put it in their mouth, but by the 15th try, they swallow, and we're like, oh, I'm tired now, you know? But it does take that kind of, for some foods, not always. And, you know, progress is different. It'll happen quicker at some times than others. But some of the tips and tricks are, the first thing we got to do is reduce competition. If I give you a plate of French fries and a plate of broccoli, broccoli's losing. It's just a simple fact. And so coming home at the end of the day from a hard day when we've got tons of things going on and we're trying to go in and cook dinner, if we've got pre-chopped fruit and some cheese in the refrigerator to lay out there, that, if we only lay it out there by itself, has a better chance of being eaten than if we also lay out the cold fish and the crackers and things like that too. 50-50 hacks. This is something we do all the time and talk about all the time with our MaxLove families. Some of these kids are on ketogenic diets for different types of oncology situations, and they might have only ever eaten rice, and all of a sudden we're trying to get them to eat cauliflower rice because it's got way less carbohydrates in it. And so those, you know, getting them there by degrees is something that really works. So we start off with a frozen bag of cauliflower rice and dump that in while we're making rice, and we can get 10% cauliflower rice in there to begin with. And then slowly, slowly put that up until we're, you know, at 90% cauliflower rice. And there's so many different things you can do that with. You can do that with your mashed potatoes. You can do that with hamburgers, tacos, spaghetti, all kinds of things where you start off slow with something like that and gradually build up in your vegetable content and get it in that way. And then you sensitize those taste buds. Using favorite food as a bridge, we've already talked about that a little bit. Using sauces to dip in, we get to work with a lot of chefs at MaxLove, and they've healthified tzatziki sauce, ranch dip, barbecue sauce, with all kinds of additions to make it sweeter like that. Across the bottom is a lot of different recipes we've created at MaxLove, and I have some recipe books back there that you can see some of these recipe books as well. But the tzatziki sauce is on the left. We've utilized a lot of shredded veggies and a shredded veggie patty in the second that we saute in a little bit of olive oil surrounded by flax. the protein pancake in the middle, where we would take out some of the more refined flours and added in things like the buckwheat or almond flours, coconut flours. Kids love to skewer stuff, and so if you cut fruits and veggies into a same amount and then stream them along with some cheese, that's a fun way to do it. And then one of the funnest things we've done is with beets. And so I have never met a kid that would eat a beet right off the bat. It's like, I've had two say to me, it was hilarious once. This little guy had a little bit of an accent. He said, "It tastes like dirt." And it was funny. I was like, right? But when you roast a beet and you turn it into this gorgeous hot pink hummus, the girls are just like, whew, let me try that, you know? And we've also done a thing where we put it in a sachet and put it in a thing of water to make a beet and lemon lemonade. And the swirl of that roasted beet coming out in the water was, I mean, you got so many oohs and ahs about that the kids were just dying to taste that. So there's fun ways you can do it. Protein when it's hard to eat. So the texture is something that's often complained about. It takes too much effort to chew. It's too hard. So the ground meats, the hamburgers, the tacos, the easiest thing in the whole world is to put some frozen chicken breasts in a crock pot, dump some bone broth in there, and then 8 hours later, give it a good stir, and you've got a really soft chicken that can add to quesadillas, that can add to tacos, all kinds of stuff that can get rid of some of that. I always have a little bit of a discussion about protein powder because that's something that a lot of my parents are really interested in. There's so many different kinds out on the market. One thing that's probably really important to know is that it's an ultra-processed food most of the time. And so when you have an ultra-processed food, it's not something you can make in your own kitchen with normal ingredients that you can buy at the grocery store. It's an industrial product, number one. And it doesn't have as much nutrients as a full-fledged animal protein or plant-based protein. However, there could be instances where it can be helpful. As you get up in the older grades, sports and things like that, it's a more portable protein, something that you can have access to that way. There's been a tremendous amount of study about what kind of protein in an infant or a premature infant will help them make muscle better than, say, another type of protein. Generally, your animal-based proteins, like your whey from dairy, will make the most and best muscle the quickest, whereas pea doesn't do the job as well. There's a lot of plant-based proteins that cause a lot of problems in terms of heavy metal exposure. There's a lot of companies out there right now that are getting third-party tested for pea protein for heavy metals. Just look for a stamp that says they are if you like to do that. And there could be a lot of reasons why a child can't do whey protein, allergens for one thing. But hemp is a protein that I like to use a lot if they prefer to go plant-based because it does tend to have less heavy metal exposure and it's got a lot of that anti-inflammatory fat. Hemp is from the cannabis plant, but in the United States, hemp powder cannot have any THC and be sold in the United States. Cruciferous veggies is the other one that's really hard to eat, and we are two slides from being done, and then we're going to have some fun. But I know for me personally, cruciferous veggies was the hardest. When a plant is a baby, when it comes out on a stem and you've got two or three leaves, it's called a sprout, or it's like a baby spinach, baby kale, baby chard, it equates to much more mild flavor. You retain the nutrients more when it's uncooked, especially in that sprout form, and it can be added to all kinds of things with almost no taste difference at all, but still have all those nutrients. So the smoothies, the dips, the sandwich toppers, topping avocado toast, if that's something your child will take, but also chopping small and adding to those rice dishes after the rice dishes are done. And so all those cruciferous veggies, like cauliflower rice is a cruciferous veggie, and the 50-50 hack works for that too. Allium, onions, it cracks me up when a kid won't eat an onion with a piece of chicken, but they'll eat it in salsa. But sometimes shaving and grating the onion will help get rid of some of that more bitter taste. Also cooking it a little bit so that it is more mild will get that done as well. And then fennel is something that is incredibly valuable for digestive issues and a pro-motility agent for constipation issues. But it has that strong licorice taste to it. Roasting will give it a more mild flavor. Roasting it with chicken and chopping it small so that it can adhere to some of those chicken pieces is a great way to do that as well. And so this is an example for a diet, and I'm so sorry that you can't read it very well. But the whole point of putting this up there is like, that would be perfection, right? And we don't want perfection to be the enemy of the good. We want to be able to start wherever we're at and add things, tablespoons at a time. So if you feel as though your child is not there yet in terms of fruits and veggies, an easy way to start is just to use any one of the tips and tricks and go to a farmer's market type of thing. But everything that was on that table this morning had a fruit or vegetable in it. But if you don't think your child will eat it, starting small and starting with really tiny pieces is a great way to do it. All right, so we are going to have a Q&A session, but we have a 5-minute craft that needs 5 minutes to set up. So we're going to start our food craft, and then we're going to have Q&A, and then we're going to launch into a culinary medicine class that I do with kids because it's a fiber one, and it is a lot of fun, and it's something that they know and love, which is a granola bar, and it can be made in a bag. And so the fun game to learn about fiber, the concept is that when we eat food, our body makes trash. When we have things coming in from the outside, like BPA in water bottles, like, for example, things that come in on our body has a way of getting rid of that, and that's called poop. And when we talk about poop with a five-year-old, they are in. They are so excited about it. And so this craft shows a kid what it's like to have a fibrous substance help clean up the trash in the GI tract. And so on the left side of that table back there, there are baggies and a teaspoon to use with flour, and then chia and water. And I am going to kick myself because I just realized I forgot the chia. I cannot believe this. I am so incredibly sorry about that. I'm looking over there and telling you where the chia is, and the chia is gone. Who's made chia pudding here? Everybody? Thank God. Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to show you what it looks like when you blow up a bag, and then you put a little flour in there. This, I'm so sad I can't show you this, guys, because it's really, really quite fun. Take your child. Blow up your bag a little, put a little moisture in there, and put a little fiber in there. Seal the bag up and run it around. And you can show your child how the fiber sticks to the baggie. That's all it's going to take. And then you're going to put 1 tablespoon of chia seed in there and then 3 tablespoons of water. Seal it again. Set your timer for 5 minutes. It's going to gel completely. I just practiced this the other day with a bunch of kids, and it worked beautifully. So I'm so sad that I can't show it to you. But you can see the flour all stuck to the sides of the bag. When you make the chia and wait 5 minutes, it gels completely. The kids can feel it with their hands. They can touch it. They can see it. And then you can squish that fiber all over the bag and see it pick up all of the flour. You snip with the scissors a thing out of here, and then you pour it out like poop, because the kids think this is the greatest as well, and you can see the rest of the bag is clean when you're done. And it's really a fun craft to show the kids what fiber can do, and it explains it really well. So that's our food craft. I'm sorry you didn't get to do it, and I'm just crushed that I did this. You should see my list. It looks really good, but chia seeds was not on my list. I'm picturing it right now. But I do have all the ingredients for the granola bar in the bag. And so you have the recipe on your table. These recipes that were made by all the chefs, and you can look through the cookbooks that we've made for Max Love Project on the table there as well. But the recipe was made for choice, for autonomy. So you can set up your granola items in a row and add them all to your bag. The recipe has a set of 12 on the left-hand side, the total ingredients, but over to the right, you'll see just the tablespoon sizes for a single serving. Again, you can make it in a bag. And what's cool about this is that even a one-year-old can get in on the game. Because if you've got the older kids, the 2, 3, and 4-year-olds, they can, you know, utilize the tablespoons and things like that, pouring their ingredients in. But even one-year-olds can squish. And so they can make it all together. And then you have the dough for the granola bars, and these are designed not to be baked. And so you can roll it right out into a paper plate, and then use a cookie cutter to shape it into a shape as well, which gives a lot of autonomy, gives a child to play with food, and then gives them choice as well. So if they've never eaten a pumpkin seed before, before they even put it in their bag and choose to make that a part of their granola bar, they can taste a pumpkin seed or lick it or smell it to see if that's something that they would be interested in. Same thing with the coconut, same thing with the sunflower seeds and the cashews. And then this recipe can be modified in so many different ways. If you don't want to do the cashews, sliced almonds will absolutely work. I brought cacao nibs today because cacao nibs are so incredibly nutrient dense. They've got magnesium, they've got all kinds of minerals. They can be used as a great sub for a chocolate chip, but a lot of kids haven't been exposed to them, and they are crunchy. By themselves, they're a little bit more on the bitter side, but combined with all the rest of the ingredients in the bag, they're fun, and they still blend that chocolate taste, and so it just makes a more nutrient-dense type of granola bar. You could do a half-and-half hack here, where you could do half oats, and then just add in some of these nuts and seeds. So the choice is yours. The recipe is simple because you can just add more honey or more almond butter if you want to make a more wet type of granola bar, or you can have a more dry one that you could mix with like a Greek yogurt or something like that. All right, who's excited about making a granola bar? I think you, on your recipe, you've got the single serving one, and so all the supplies are up there, and I'll be up there too.